Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we cover some recent developments in the public safety workplace. First of all, though, just a bit of an apology. I'm sort of muddling my way through day 7 of what's supposed to be a 24-hour cold, and it's going to pose some editing problems for our producer, Mark Fuller, so I just hope you bear with me. We have a very packed agenda for today's podcast. We've got some really interesting decisions that have come down in the last 30 days. In particular, we've got our first three post-Janus cases decided from various places around the country. They're pretty interesting cases. We have a case out of the United States Supreme Court involving a small fire district down in Arizona that gives a new definition to the scope of the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. I also want to talk to you about last chance agreements and how they work and whether they're negotiable. We've got a last chance case that involves an attempt to arbitrate the employee's eventual discharge pursuant to a last chance agreement. We'll talk about whether there's anything left to arbitrate. And a potpourri of other decisions. May not get to them all. I'll pick them up on in January's podcast because courts tend to slow down towards the end of December. But we've got other cases on who are comparable employees for purposes of race and age and gender discrimination. Got a case involving a polygraph examination out of Maryland and whether all details concerning a polygraph examination are potentially barred by a provision in the Bill of Rights. We also have a new case on the relationship between the Americans with Disabilities Act and the obligation under the ADA to reasonably accommodate somebody's disability running headlong into a provision in a collective bargaining agreement. What under those circumstances ends up prevailing. So that's our landscape that I'm going to try to cover most of. But let's start with our first three post-Janus cases that we've seen come down. Janus versus AFSCME, of course, is the decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in June of this year in which the court held that fair share provisions in a collective bargaining agreement, those provisions that required people who chose not to be members of a labor organization to pay their fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering a collective bargaining agreement, the court held that those provisions violated the First Amendment. That spawned all sorts of litigation around the country, a lot of it sponsored by the same cast of characters, kind of loosely knit group of nonprofit organizations that are devoted to ending unionism in the public sector. Now, foremost among them, of course, the Right to Work Foundation out of Virginia, but there's a bunch of different ones that are around the country. Pretty much all of them are funded at least in part, if not in substantial part, by the Koch brothers. And these organizations are very active, and they've made their intentions very well known at this point. They don't intend to stop until there are no more public sector labor organizations. Well, the first of these cases is one that has been filed in a number of states, but I think this is the first decision out there in the country. This comes out of Washington. And this involves a group of Washington employees backed by one of these nonprofits who sued the what's known as Council 28 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME Council 28. What were they looking for? They wanted a refund of all fair share assessments that they had paid prior to the Janus decision. So what they're saying is, look, Janus held that fair share was unconstitutional. It's always been unconstitutional. It was unconstitutional before Janus. It just took the Supreme Court until Janus to get around to make that decision. Therefore, we should be entitled to our money back. And a federal court, federal trial court, interestingly, a very conservative judge, he's, I think, an appointee of President Ronald Reagan, agreed with Council 28 that it was completely shielded by what's known as the good faith defense. So what's the good faith defense? The good faith defense means that there's no liability under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act, and because there's a First Amendment violation here, the lawsuit has to be under the Civil Rights Act. There's no liability if the defendant is acting in good faith. If they had no reason to know that the statute, in this case the Fair Share Statute in Washington, upon which they relied was unconstitutional. And the court finds that that good faith defense applied to bar the lawsuit seeking the recovery of the fair share fees. Here's what the court is saying, and I'm quoting, "When engaging in bargaining representation and other pro-union activities funded by agency fees, Council 28 followed the then applicable laws. Because prior to Janus, collection and use of compelled agency fees was lawful. The constitutional defect, compelling collection of agency fees, could not have been identified by Council 28 because although the Supreme Court hinted at overruling Abood, that's its prior decision upholding the constitutionality of fair share, it did not explicitly do so until Janus." The court ends up saying, look here, AFSCME and the state immediately stopped collecting agency fees right after Janus. Hence, the good faith defense bars any recovery of those fair share fees deducted prior to the Janus decision. A pretty predictable decision, but nonetheless, these lawsuits have been filed, as I said, all over the country. There's a big one on file down in California involving state employees down in California. Second up is a case from New Mexico, and this one is not from the court system. This is actually from what's known as the New Mexico Public Employees Labor Relations Board. So this case occurs in the context of an unfair labor practice complaint. And what goes on here, this is employer-initiated action. In this case, it involved the city of Rio Rancho, which decided that all employees, not just fair share members, needed to sign new dues authorization cards in the wake of Janus. Now, this is a position that had been circulating quite a bit among employer groups, leagues of cities and counties around the country, but I haven't actually seen many employers try to take this position. Rio Rancho did. And the position is, you know, prior to Janus, you were giving employees a choice between being full members and fair share members, but fair share was unconstitutional. Therefore, how do we know that somebody who ended up choosing to be a full member would not have dropped out of the union entirely had fair share not been on the table? And therefore, says the city of Rio Rancho, we're not going to collect any dues from any employee who does not sign a new post-Janus authorization card. And the Labor Relations Board in New Mexico ends up summarily finding that the city of Rio Rancho violated the law by insisting on new dues authorization cards. The board ends up concluding that the city's actions here may exceed what was required under the Janus decision when withholding union dues from union members. As I mentioned, this is sort of an unusual decision in that most employers ended up deciding not to go this way. Typically, when an employer started thinking about it, a union would send a letter to the employer saying, don't you dare do that. That will be an unfair labor practice. Well, looks like that's going to be an unfair labor practice. Okay. Third case. This comes to us out of a federal court in California, up in the Bay Area, Contra Costa County. It's involved an employee there named Mark Smith, and it looked at a very different issue than these first two cases. If an employee signed a dues authorization card for a fixed period of time, does Janus allow the employee to terminate the authorization before the, whatever the term of the authorization is, expires? So in this case, Smith becomes a member of AFSCME Local 2700, and he did that on January 4th, 2006. And he signed a dues authorization card in which he agreed to pay dues for a year. And at the end of the year, which would have been the start of 2017, we're still pre-Janus now, okay? So at the end of the year, start of 2017, what happens? Well, the agreement that he signed said it's not revocable until the next termination date, the end of the year, or the next termination date of the collective bargaining agreement between the employer and the union. And when he signed that card, Smith consented to the dues deduction for the full contractual period of time. Whenever that, as they call them in California, MOU, Memorandum of Agreement, every place else we call them collective bargaining agreements, until that MOU expired. Janus comes down, MOU is not expired. Smith said, I don't want to pay anymore. I want out. What does the federal court say? And I'm quoting, Janus does not give Smith license to evade his contract. The Janus plaintiffs had opted out of union membership prior to the case. By contrast, Smith had opted into union membership before Janus was decided. Smith wants Janus to stand for the proposition that any union member can change his mind at the drop of a hat, invoke the First Amendment, and renege on his contractual obligation to pay dues. Far from standing for that proposition, Janus actually acknowledges that employees can waive their First Amendment rights by affirmatively consenting to pay union dues. That's what Smith did. Now, this case, the result in this case, I don't think is terribly unexpected, but it raises an interesting question for unions moving forward from this point in time. What do they want their dues authorization cards to look like? Do they want their authorization cards to allow an employee to be able to end their union membership at any point in time? Or do they want to lock them in, as was the case in Smith, lock them in for a fixed period of time? I suspect most unions are going to want to have fixed authorization cards for a period of time. And the reason is union expenses are amortized out over a long period of time and a large number of bargaining unit members. You don't want someone popping in and out of union membership when they have a grievance that may cost the union tens of thousands of dollars to process, and then once the grievance is over, simply walking away. And the Smith case and Janus itself, I think, stand for the proposition that those fixed authorization periods are going to be constitutional under Janus. Next up, the Supreme Court tackles the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Another apology for you before I start into this. We're about to enter the exciting world of statutory construction. This is going to be an incredibly technical case. The only blessing is, I promise you, this discussion will be short. This comes out of the Mount Lemmon Fire District, which is a political subdivision down in Arizona. It faced some financial difficulties, and it laid off its two oldest firefighters, John Guido, who was then 46, and Dennis Rankin, who was then 54. Guido and Lemon sue the district, and they say, hey, we are the victims of age discrimination. Age discrimination is prohibited under this longstanding federal law known as the ADEA, or the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. The fire district's response is that it was too small to qualify as an employer under the ADEA, that it just simply wasn't covered by the law. And so here's how the ADEA, the statutory scheme, exists. Under the ADEA, an employer is, at least as the ADEA started life, an employer was a person engaged in an industry affecting commerce who has 20 or more employees. So there's a 20-employee threshold under the ADEA, but it's only that threshold only applied to the private sector, because that's who the ADEA applied to in the first place. 1974, Congress amended the ADEA to cover state and local governments like the fire district. The 1974 amendments made no reference to this minimum number of employees for public sector agencies, but instead specified that the definition of covered employer, that one I just read you, person engaged in commerce who has 20 or more employees, they just simply tacked on a phrase to the end of that. And the phrase they tacked on was that a covered employer, that definition, and I'm quoting, also means a state or political subdivision of the state. And the Supreme Court had to look at that language, put it all together, and decide, are public sector employers that have less than 20 employees covered by the ADEA? And in one of its very rare these days unanimous decisions, the Supreme Court said, yes, they are covered. And here's what the court's analysis was. The court found that that phrase also means, where the definition of the covered employer also means a state or political subdivision, also means, and I'm quoting, adds new categories of employers to the ADEA's reach. We think the ordinary meaning of also means, quotes, is additive rather than clarifying. The court goes on to say that you have to read the word also to create a separate category of employer. So you have on one hand private sector employers who have to have 20 or more employees to be covered by the ADEA, and then also means everybody else, all the public sector employers without regard to size. Now, there's one paragraph at the end of the court's opinion. It's not really all that germane to the court's opinion, but it's sort of an interesting paragraph that I want to read you. And this is where the court, typically the way these court opinions are written is the court will announce whatever its decision it's going to be. It'll analyze the law and any prior cases and all of that sort of stuff. And then they'll, at the end of the opinion, list the arguments that the losing party made and then strike them all down. It's sort of adding insult to injury on many occasions. And this is that latter phase of the court's opinion. And here, and let me read you this paragraph. The fire district warns that applying the ADEA to small public entities risks curtailment of vital public services such as fire protection. Experience suggests otherwise. For 30 years, the EEOC has consistently interpreted the ADEA as we do today, and a majority of states forbid age discrimination by political subdivisions of any size. Some 15 of these states subject private sector employers to age discrimination proscriptions only if they employ a threshold number of workers. No untoward service shrinkages have been documented. So in other words, don't come to us with this defense that, you know, if you apply the ADEA or any anti-discrimination statutes like this to small public employers, public service is going to be curtailed. The Supreme Court could have answered that in a different way. It could have answered that argument simply by saying, hey, not our issue. Take that to Congress. That's a policy decision. That's something that Congress is much more adept at answering than we are. In any case, that's the end of it. Small employers are subject to the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. All right, now let's talk last chance agreements. We've got this case that comes down to us involving a Connecticut firefighter. But let me, before I get into the facts of that case, let me take a step back and just describe the landscape a little bit of last chance agreements. So to begin with, what's a last chance agreement? And sometimes these things have different names. They're not called that. They might be called return to work agreements. They might be called work contracts. No matter what they're called, they sort of all deal with the same sort of factual situation. You have an employee who is messing up by the numbers. The employer works with the employee, perhaps engages in the progressive discipline process, and nothing seems to really solve the employee's problems. And the employee then commits another act of misconduct, an act that would justify the employee's discharge. That's kind of fact scenario number one that leads us up to a last chance agreement. The second is you have a longtime employee who's a good employee, and then all of a sudden they do something that is a total aberration. They've given no indication that they are capable of engaging in this type of misconduct, and then out of the blue, the misconduct happens. So that's fact situation number two. And in both of those, the employer looks at the employee and says, you know what? We don't really want to fire you. You've given us cause to fire you, but we believe that if we give you a last chance, you'll be able to take the steps necessary to rehabilitate yourself, to change, whether it's change in many of these cases involve substance abuse, whether it's change that might result in you getting some inpatient treatment for substance abuse, whether it's retraining, whatever it might be. So here's the deal that we are going to offer you, employee. You agree that for this particular event, this act of misconduct, you will serve a suspension of this length, whatever it is. Usually these are pretty severe suspensions, 30-day suspensions and the like. You also agree you won't challenge that suspension through the labor agreement. You agree that you will take these steps for rehabilitation, whatever they are, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever they are. And you also agree that for a period of time, once you come back to work, if you do the same stuff again, we have the right to fire you, and you will not have the ability to challenge that termination through whatever the contractual grievance procedure is. Now, those sorts of agreements are enforceable with one caveat. And the caveat is that if they are used in a collective bargaining environment where there's a union on the scene, these sorts of agreements have to have the union as a party. If they don't, it's the unfair labor practice that's commonly known as direct dealing. The employer can't reach a one-on-one agreement with an individual bargaining unit member about something that's a mandatory subject of bargaining. And last chance agreements concern all sorts of mandatory subjects of bargaining. They certainly concern discipline and discharge. They concern access to the grievance procedure. They may have implications in terms of work requirements and hours of work and even compensation. So these agreements concern mandatory subjects of bargaining, hence the union has to be a party. But if the union is a party, they are enforceable. So what's this Connecticut case all about? Because that law that I just described is pretty well set by this point in time. Well, this is a case that involves Thomas Eccleston. He's a firefighter for the city of Waterbury, Connecticut. Eccleston is arrested and charged with third-degree assault and breach of the peace in the second degree. He gets placed on administrative leave pending the completion of an investigation. And at the end of the investigation, Eccleston and his labor organization sign a last chance agreement. City's doing it right, right? They've got the union signing on to the last chance agreement. By the way, in addition to that being legally required, that's just simply a good idea, because when the union signs on to a last chance agreement, that's giving a pretty powerful message to an employee who is troubled. And that's the sort of message I think the employer wants to have the union joining in giving. So this last chance agreement calls for Eccleston to be subject to random drug testing, and provided that Eccleston is subject to immediate termination if he tested positive for a controlled substance or violated any of the city's policies or engaged in any misconduct, and that he would not have access to the grievance procedure to challenge his termination. Well, you know, since I called out drug testing, you know what's going to happen, right? And it happens. Within a couple of years of signing the last chance agreement, Eccleston tests positive for marijuana on a random drug test. He admits that he used marijuana and says, hey, I've got a medical marijuana card. The city says, we don't care. Fires him, and the association, the Firefighters Association, challenges the termination in arbitration. Here's where this case goes off the rails a little bit. So far, everything kind of standard. The city files a lawsuit trying to prevent arbitration of the grievance. And the city's argument is, hey, this last chance agreement is clear on its face. He's subject to random drug testing. If he uses a controlled substance, he's subject to immediate discharge. He took a drug test. He failed it. We can fire him. He doesn't have access to the grievance procedure. That's the city's argument. And the court isn't impressed. In fact, the court actually calls the city's argument, the city's interpretation of the last chance agreement, as, and I'm quoting here, myopic. And here's what the court says. And by the way, I think the court's opinion, even though it probably shouldn't have used the word myopic, I think the court's opinion's really right on here. I think it's absolutely correct. The court's opinion is saying, look, the last chance agreement doesn't really do one thing, which is what the city says. It doesn't deny the employee access to the grievance procedure if they meet one of these conditions. That's not the only thing that this last chance agreement does. The other thing it does is it sets up the conditions that trigger the possibility that the employee can be discharged and then would have no access to the grievance procedure. That other condition, in this case, you know, subject to random drug testing, comply with the department's rules and the like, that's a factual issue. And that factual issue, we just simply cannot assume is necessarily proven by the facts that we have before us. Whether or not that factual predicate that would trigger the last chance agreement is met in this case, that's for an arbitrator. So let me read you the last paragraph in the court's opinion that I think lays this out very well. The court says, it's clear that the city is attempting to preclude the association and Eccleston from exercising their contractual rights to arbitrate the single issue of the underlying conduct. While the city may be reluctant to arbitrate the issues of what underlying conduct Eccleston engaged in, and whether the conduct satisfied one of the conditions outlined in the last chance agreement, the court can say with positive assurance that a fair construction of the last chance agreement indicates that the city specifically agreed to arbitrate these matters. And then the court gives some reassurance to the city. If the city's correct that Eccleston's alleged use of medical marijuana amounted to the use of a controlled substance under the relevant laws or violated the city's policies, then it should have no difficulty establishing such in the proper forum. And the proper forum is arbitration. So what you have with these last chance agreements then is you have this two-part analysis. Did, in fact, the employee engage in misconduct that triggered the last chance agreement? And then what happens if the employee engaged in the misconduct? And a last chance agreement doesn't allow an employer to unilaterally determine whether the first of those conditions, did the employee engage in misconduct, actually is satisfied. Next case I want to talk about is one out of the Cleveland Fire Department. This is my fire department month, isn't it? Next case after this one will be a police case. And this is a race discrimination case, and it involves the question of who are comparable employees for discrimination purposes. So how does that question ever come up? Why are we even looking for comparable employees? Well, most discrimination cases, whether they're race discrimination or gender discrimination or religious discrimination, no matter what, most discrimination cases don't involve direct proof of discrimination. It's a very rare employer that is ever going to look at an employee and say, I'm firing you because you're a woman or because you're Jewish or because you're Hispanic. You're just not going to find direct evidence of discrimination. That would be a pretty incautious employer. Instead, most race or most discrimination cases involve evidence that implies that discrimination was the motive for the employer's decision, whatever the decision was. And long ago, 1973, in a case involving McDonnell Douglas Corporation, the Supreme Court set up a three-part test for when you can infer race discrimination from an employer's actions. And this has become known as the McDonnell Douglas case, and it shows up time and time and time again. I probably read 36 McDonnell Douglas cases every month. This is just the law of the land with regard to how probably 99% of these discrimination cases are analyzed. So what are the three parts of the McDonnell Douglas test? They're pretty easy to set forth. The first is the employee has a burden of coming forward with what's known as a prima facie case. And that's easy. The employee just has to show they are in a protected class. They wouldn't be suing unless they were in a protected class. They're in a protected class. And secondly, that the employer took some sort of adverse employment action against the employee. That's a light burden of proof. So the employee has to show that. Let's assume they have. Then the burden swings over to the employer to show that it had a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for taking whatever action it took against the employee. Many of these cases involve discipline or failure to promote. Whatever the action is, the employer just has to show a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. And if the employer meets that burden, then the burden of proof shifts back to the employee to show that the reason that the employer offered, whatever business justification the employer comes up with, that was a pretext for discrimination. And that's where the action is in these discrimination cases. It deals with the issue of pretext. That's where the vast majority of these race and gender discrimination cases are resolved. So how do employees prove pretext? Well, they can prove it in a number of different ways. They can show, for example, that decision makers made statements that were hostile to the employee's protected class. They can show a general discriminatory workplace on the part of the employee. They can show that a close timing between the employees engaging in protected activity. For example, it might be the protected activity might be speech and when the employer's action was taken, or it might be that the employee lodged a discrimination claim and then was disciplined 2 days afterwards. So timing can lead to an inference of pretext. But the most common of them is that there are other employees who are not in the protected class, not in a protected class, not just the protected class, other employees who are not in a protected class who engaged in similar conduct but who were not treated as harshly by the employer. So this is an effort on the part of the employee to say, look, the employer's business justification here was that I did this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Other employees did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They weren't in a protected class. They weren't treated the same way I was. Ergo, pretext for discrimination. And courts really don't like these comparable employee inquiries. You can see that in their opinions time and time again. It's almost like trying to decide how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. They don't want to get into the fine points of whether this employee is similarly situated to that employee. So these arguments often fail. And so they failed in this Cleveland firefighter case. This is a case that involved actually 13 firefighters to begin with, including Calvin Robinson. And all of these employees plead guilty in criminal court to something that under Ohio statutes is known as complicity, and it might be in other states conspiracy. And the underlying allegation is that they abused a policy allowing firefighters to exchange shifts as long as the exchange was repaid by the employee within 1 year. In other words, they were manipulating the system. Big story in Cleveland. It was in the papers all the time. And 13 firefighters, as I said, ended up pleading guilty to a criminal charge, including Robinson. So after all these guilty pleas come in, the city has to decide what discipline it is going to give these 13 employees. 12 of them, all of whom are Caucasian, get 9-month suspensions. Robinson, who is African American, gets fired. The city, when it does terminate Robinson, cites the magnitude of his abuse of the shift trade policy, and Robinson isn't buying it. He sues under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, and he says, you discharged me because of my race. And the whole case comes down to the question of pretext. And Robinson's argument for pretext is, I got these 12 guys, these 12 Caucasian firefighters who did what I did, and they didn't get fired. And the court rejects the argument. Remember I told you, courts don't like this comparable employee argument. Here's the court's analysis. It is undisputed that Robinson's shift trade imbalance of, get ready for this, 10,098 hours between 2006 and 2011 is nearly double the shift trade imbalance of the next most egregious offender's imbalance of 5,308 hours. Think about that for a moment. Robinson owes 10,000 hours of work due to his shift trade imbalance. Somebody else actually owed 5,000. That's pretty stunning. That's kind of nobody's minding the story. Okay, back to the court's opinion. Additionally, Robinson worked only 24 hours in 2009, 0 hours in 2010, and 8 hours in 2011, before being informed he could no longer engage in shift trading. Okay, here comes the court's decision. Robinson has presented no evidence that the city's reasoning, that he was the worst offender by far, had no basis in fact, did not actually motivate the termination of his employment, or was an insufficient reason to motivate the termination of his employment. Therefore, the court says, Robinson has failed to rebut the city's legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for his termination. Race alone won't suffice in the evidence of different degrees of misconduct. Last up, I want to talk about the latest case holding that body cameras are a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. We've seen a string of these cases now. They've come down from all over the country. Probably the biggest of them is the one involving the Chicago Police Department. But holdings that body cams are mandatory for bargaining, we've also seen them in states such as Oklahoma and Maryland. And it's just a general theme that because body cameras have all sorts of workplace implications, and in particular implications on the disciplinary system, that the implementation of a body camera system is mandatory for bargaining. Well, time to add Nebraska to the list. This is a case involving corrections officers who work for the state of Nebraska. And they're represented by Local 61 of AFSCME. And there's a management rights clause in the collective bargaining agreement that actually grants the state the right to introduce new or improved methods, equipment, technology, or facilities. So that's a grant of the right to introduce new equipment. How this case comes up is that a major at what's known as the Tecumseh State Correctional Institution gave notice that as of August 28, 2017, body cams would be used in three locations at the institution, and that later on the body cams program would expand. When the department actually put the body cameras in use, Local 61 filed an unfair labor practice complaint alleging that it had the right to bargain over the impact of the introduction of body cameras. So a couple of things about that that I think are important to discuss. First of all, the union didn't file an unfair labor practice complaint here until the employer actually implemented the program, when it had prior notice that the employer was going to implement the program. That's an issue that's not analyzed in the decision I'm about to describe for you. But usually, labor boards will hold that the obligation to insist on your bargaining rights is triggered by the employer giving notice of the intent to change a mandatory subject to bargaining, not the actual implementation of the change. And here the union waited until the change was implemented. We don't know whether or not there was a reason for that. Perhaps they had an agreement that the union could wait. Perhaps they were actually engaged in negotiations. We just don't know from the opinion here why that is the case. But it's just not a good practice for unions, once they get notice of an intended change, to simply stand on their rights and not assert the right to bargain. The second thing is, you'll notice that I said that the unfair labor practice complaint alleged that the state had an obligation to bargain over the impact of the usage of body cameras. Impact, and this is sometimes called effects, that's a type of bargaining that is distinguished from what's known as decisional bargaining. With decisional bargaining, the employer has to bargain over whatever the decision is, as well as the impact of the decision on employees. And with impact bargaining or effects bargaining, the employer just has to bargain over the effects on employees. So, for example, very traditionally in most states, the decision whether to have layoffs is thought to be a management right. But so the employees, the union can't bargain over whether or not employees are going to be laid off, but it can bargain about the impact. How long is the will the layoff list stay in existence, or the recall from layoff list? In what order are employees recalled? Are they going to have some sort of benefits while they're on layoff status? All of those things would be the impacts of a decision to lay off an employee. Here, Local 61 is just demanding the right to bargain over the impact of the introduction of body cams. Why? Remember that management rights clause that I described that gave the employer the right to introduce equipment? Local 61 has waived the right to bargain over the decision with that clause, but it hasn't waived the right to bargain over the impact. At any rate, Local 61 files this ULP. In Nebraska, it goes to a uniquely named labor organization. It's called the Commission on Industrial Relations, or as it's called in Nebraska very commonly, the CIR. And the CIR has to decide whether or not there's anything negotiable about the implication of a body camera system. And the CIR says, yeah, it's negotiable. The CIR cites a large body of case law from the National Labor Relations Board on surveillance cameras in the workplace. It doesn't really cite much in the way of other body camera cases. It does cite one out of Jacksonville, Florida, holding that body cameras are mandatory for bargaining. But mostly it relies on this large amount of NLRB precedent that cameras in the workplace in general are mandatory for bargaining because they are investigatory tools, potentially investigatory tools that could lead to discipline of employees. And how does the court analyze these particular body cams? The CIR analyzed these particular body cams. It acknowledges, the stated purpose of these body cams is for controlling inmates and recording interactions with inmates, and also for providing evidence that inmates may have engaged in inappropriate conduct of some sort. The court says there's no dispute that that's true. But the court goes on. And I'm quoting now from the court's opinion. That does not mean, the Commission on Industrial Relations, that does not mean that they could not also be used for other purposes, like employee discipline. A warden testified that the recordings from the cameras could and would be used to support disciplinary actions against employees. We find that the usage of body-worn cameras unilaterally implemented by the state would vitally affect the terms and conditions of employment. That vitally affect language harkens back to that Oklahoma case I was talking about. It was a case involving the city of Oklahoma City, where an arbitrator said that the implementation of a body camera system was, and I'm quoting again, an enormous change in working conditions. The message here, I think, is pretty clear, that while employers may well have the right to put body cameras into place, they also have the obligation to bargain about the impacts, particularly the disciplinary impacts of having a body camera system. And what sorts of impacts do we see unions negotiating about? Well, the two big ones are clearly, is there the right to pre-statement review of body camera video by whoever is wearing the body camera? In other words, before giving a formal statement, whether it be an interview or whether it be a written report, about whatever incident is captured by the body camera, does the employee have the right to review the video? The overwhelming trend there in terms of policies is that employees should have the right to pre-statement review. The second issue that unions very much want to bargain about is the practice of supervisor sort of randomly reviewing body camera videos for employee compliance with employer procedures. This is sometimes called trolling. This is sometimes called trawling. Unions are very concerned about that. Employers want to do it very much. I can't tell whether there's a trend in the country as to whether trolling, I'll call it trolling, is permitted. There's a large number of agencies that prohibit it, a large number that allow it, some that allow it with some conditions such that evidence that is obtained in that fashion can only be used for retraining an employee and not disciplining an employee. But I just can't tell you with any certainty what the overall trend is in the country with respect to trolling. So that's it on body cameras. Once again, just a reminder, the cases seem to be coming in fairly uniformly here that body cameras are mandatory for bargaining. That wraps up the 2018 versions of First Thursday. Thank you for bearing with me as I'm suffering through this cold and making you remotely suffer through it. I'll be back with you next month for a new edition of First Thursday to cover some of those cases I didn't quite get to this month. And also, I'm sure there'll be more. There's always more. That's something about this business that is a certainty. There's always something new. With that, I wish you a great holiday season, and this is Will Aitchison signing off.